Begin after six taps. One, two, three, four, five, six.
Hello, you're listening to FlixWise. I'm Martin Kessler, and joining me today are two very cool cats, John Lobinger and Jason Beamish. Hello, gentlemen.
Hey.
Hello.
So we're here today to talk about Chris Marker's Sans Soleil, a film that's often described as a documentary, although I think maybe that might come into question, which is a film that's composed of footage he collected all over the world with commentary over top. There's two versions. There's an English version of the film and the French version. I don't know if you guys have watched both or just one, but there's maybe some interesting differences, but we'll get into that. Anyway, I guess, yeah, let's get things started. John, did you like Sans Soleil?
I did like Sans Soleil. So when you asked me to watch this movie, I'm an avid amateur, but I have no academic or professional background in film. And so when you invited me on the show, I was really excited. And then you said it was going to be Chris Marker's Sans Soleil. And I was totally overwhelmed. But as I've gotten into it, as this invitation to come on and talk about this really terrific film has given me an opportunity to dive into it, I've watched it like five times. This is about as dense as a film can get. So I'm a huge fan of it. I wasn't expecting to like it because there was another Frenchman who had made a video essay that was higher ranked on the BFI Sight and Sound.
Yes.
250, and I hated it, and so I was expecting to hate this.
Histoire du cinéma, for anyone who's who's curious about that.
Histoire du cinéma, for anybody that wants to have like a traumatic flashback. but yeah, no, so I was coming into this fully expecting to dislike it very much, and I am totally in love with this movie, and I'm really excited to talk to all you guys about it. So yes, I do like it.
Awesome. And Jason, how do you like Sans Soleil?
Much like Jonathan, I was not sure going into it. I obviously had watched La Jetée several times, mm-hmm. and I love that one. And it is on the same disc, so I figured, well, I'll give it a shot. This was a couple years back. And it was very difficult that first time. But I've seen it about, I think I watched it three or four times over the past couple weeks just to really let it sink in a little bit more before we got together to talk about it. And since then, my opinion has definitely gone up. I think it's a really, really good movie.
Yeah, I think it's a film that does sort of benefit from letting you kind of soak it in and think about it. And then rewatching it, there's certain images and ideas that are introduced early in the film that you don't necessarily realize are going to have a significance that becomes more apparent towards the end. This idea of maybe praying for a lost cat, and then you have the cat at the end that's missing during the volcano that he's perhaps praying for, or little things like that sort of make the film interesting to revisit and build connections within it. It was sort of funny, each version starts with a different quote. The English language version starts with the T.S. Eliot quote from Ash Wednesday, because I know that time is always time and place is always and only place, and what is actual only for one time and for only one place. But that's sort of a funny starting point, because I think the film kind of contradicts that, or maybe uses that as a starting point to present an alternative point of view. I don't know if you had any thoughts about that. Would you agree, John?
So I do agree, and I think that is one of the, I think it's one of Marker's, it's one of his tricks, it's one of the things that he does during this movie. I view Chris Marker as a bit of a cinematic trickster.
Right.
And one, you know, he does lots of things. He refers to a lot of other literary and musical and other films. He makes lots of references, so he's doing that. He starts off with that here. T.S. Eliot is an interesting choice. Because he's about as far away on the political spectrum as you can get from Chris Marker. Also an interesting choice, though, because this is a guy that pretty famously used montage, and his whole approach to modernism is similar to Chris Marker's approach in this film. So, yeah, right off the bat, I think Chris Marker is telling you what he's going to do, and what he's going to do is mess with you. And, yeah, and I hadn't thought about it as deeply. I had just thought, oh, this is a poet talking about time and place, and it's a modernist poet, so... But when you had mentioned, wait a second, doesn't he undercut this during the movie? Well, yeah, I hadn't thought about it, but yes, of course he does. And that's what he's going to do to almost every single thing that he says or anything that the narrator or the letter writer or there's just, it's a hall of mirrors in this movie. I think there is a lot of interesting truths to be gleaned from it, but absolutely, this is right off the bat, he's trying to use a little sleight of hand. Give you an illusion right off the bat, and he's telling you the whole time that this is what to expect.
I think that's exactly right. I think, like you said, during the film, there's a lot of instances of maybe images contradicting the narration. There's instances of the narration contradicting the narration. There's instances of sound and images that don't match, and it's constantly sort of presenting ideas and then maybe challenging what's being presented through juxtaposition. Which is something that I think Histoire de Cinema actually does occasionally successfully. But I don't know. Jason, do you think that's about right? Or did you have a different reaction?
No, it's absolutely correct. I mean, that quote doesn't really even apply to film at all. Because at no point in time with very few exceptions, do you actually have a completely linear where time is always time.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And it actually, thinking about it right now, makes me think of F for Fake.
Yeah, that's a good comparison, too. Yeah.
Right from the get-go, he says, you know, for the next 60 however minutes, I will not lie to you. And then 80 minutes in, he's like, you know, 60 minutes passed 20 minutes ago. You know, so yeah. Everything, it's just changes and you get lost in a moment and you have no idea what's going to happen. And then you're just told blatantly that you've been lied to the whole time.
Absolutely. So, like, I do think it's strange that this film is usually referred to as a documentary. I don't think that label really applies to what it is.
Yeah, so I'm just going to jump in here. No, I do not think of this as a documentary. I think this is a lot closer to a prose poem, or people have called it video essay, or a film essay, or even a personal documentary or a travelogue. No, I think it's something different. If you're expecting to have the narrative structure of a documentary, you're just not going to get it. And even if you're just thinking you're going to get some collection of montage, while there is a lot of that, and that's clearly one of the things that's used, it's something different than that. There is a lot of, there's an active intellectual discussion going on with lots of tricks and lots of different distractions. But if you're, it never felt to me like, when I first got into the movie the first time, I thought I was watching a really bad documentary.
Right.
And when eventually, I think it was the first time that you get to the Spectron video synthesizer.
Yes.
Going over the...
the revolutionary going footage. Over, sure.
Oh, it was the kamikazes.
Oh, right.
That was, yes, when it hit me that what I have just been experiencing is somebody has been lulling me and sort of leading me down all these hallways until eventually I'm being forced to face my own mortality.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the really harsh truths about history that when we see them in movies over and over again, they're part of a narrative, and so they're anesthetized that way. And I feel like a lot of the movie is to get you to follow these different strands that you would not follow if you could see them coming. And that doesn't strike me very much as a documentary. What I just described doesn't feel like a documentary.
No, and like a lot of the little threads that you follow, they don't always lead to where you'd expect. And you have to work backwards a little bit to figure out what the connections were exactly and maybe reconsider or recontextualize what you've just seen. Or were you wondering, Jason, what might be real or not? Or did you question what was being shown?
Not really at any point in time. you have to put a little bit of trust in there, even though most of them, you know, are actively trying to deceive you. But there was nothing that really took me out of it too much.
And I don't know, John, what did you think about some of the little fictional elements being added in, or the perhaps questionable bits of narration mixed in with some of the images that you see, so that you're not sure if what's being said really is what's being shown to you, or things like that. Yeah.
Sure. So yeah. So oh gosh, there's so many different things I want to say about that. One, I think part of this is Chris Marker's philosophy about authorship, and as well as his history in collective filmmaking. Like, he was a militant. He was working with militants in the '60s and collectives to help them with their revolutionary efforts, particularly with films and those sorts of things. And so the idea of messing around with authorship, a lot of time he attributes, like Sandor Krasna, the guy who's writing the letters, clearly Sandor Krasna is a fictional person. The narrator is reading letters from a fictional person. And then the fictional person, Sandor, is also referring to his friends who are further fictional people. So when he's talking about the video game designer who also can run images through the, I mean, that person's totally, all of it's Chris Marker.
Right.
Yes. And so
Chris Marker isn't even really Chris Marker. So it's,
Chris Marker is a made up name. I think it's Bouche Villeneuve, and he's had, if you go on his Wikipedia page, he has about 20 different false names. It's wonderful. And this goes as far back, and you know, now I'm showing where I did get my academic pedigree in philosophy. Kierkegaard always wrote his existential essays under different names. And part of it is to mess around with, you shouldn't be trusting me just because I'm Søren Kierkegaard. And on top of that, we can get to some interesting truths if we mess around with the actual idea of truth. Whatever.
And while reading Sickness Unto Death, he became sick and nearly died. It's a Kierkegaard joke, but
there are not enough Kierkegaard jokes in the podcast I listen to. And the other thing I want to say is, you want to think of a very specific example of juxtaposition. You already mentioned the giraffe shot. That is a scene that I had blocked out of my memory, which of course is something that is discussed at length in the movie about how people in societies block things out of their memory, but whatever. So, you know, so I blocked that out of my memory. And what happens, though, when you watch the scene in Japan, is you see video games where they're killing animals in the video game, or they're using the mallets to hit the baby seal and their bosses.
Like the little, and then it trans- the whack-a-mole type game, but with the seal.
Exactly. And then it goes over to this gorgeous and very touching and poignant scene at a Japanese zoo where they're holding, every year they have essentially their Day of the Dead, or they have their prayer ceremony ritual for all the animals that have died at the zoo, and a panda had died, so it was particularly sad. But then they say the second time they're less sad, and they're intercutting this, you know, this very touching scene compared to the video game scene. And then there's a video of a kill shot of a giraffe, which is one of the most horrifying. Almost like, I don't know what that video series was, like Images of Death?
The Faces of Death.
Faces of Death. Like, I would be surprised if that scene isn't in Faces of Death somewhere. And he combines the three of them together, and I'm not exact. I have an idea of what he's trying to say, but I don't, who knows what he's really trying to say. But the three of those things playing counterpoint to each other, I about as memorable as you can get in filmmaking. And it was just, you know, I mean, That's a prime example of what you're talking about with the contrasting images.
Yeah, I think it's a film that really rewards people who like to juxtapose images and kind of get a kinetic reaction. I think anytime you have sort of contrasting images, there's a tension that exists in between them. And, you know, to break that tension, you have to build some kind of a connection. So, like, I think, you know, in this case, what becomes really interesting is just partly the variety, partly the both the similarity and then the strangeness of certain gaps between images. Like, you were talking before about how much of the narration is fictional, and then he'll throw in something like people looking into the camera which is very much associated with breaking the reality of a film. That's why it's not done really in fiction filmmaking. It's too unnerving having an extra or somebody look into camera. It sort of breaks that down. But then you start seeing Chris Marker add all these layers of artificiality to that single moment of somebody looking into camera, and he kind of builds it and reconstructs it into something that's perhaps a fiction. Like at the very end, when he digitizes that image and slows it down, it's sort of taking this one element that we associate with breaking fiction and distorts it and stretches it and digitizes it and sort of breaks the authenticity of that moment by changing it from maybe 1/24th of a frame to being a prolonged visual. So things like that I find very interesting in Sans Soleil. I don't know, Jason, were there any images that really jumped out to you that stuck out in your mind?
Well, I guess I gotta go lowbrow for a second here, because the monkey in the overalls at the beginning, I gotta be honest, sure. I love that.
When you said lowbrow, that's not where I thought you were going to go.
But... Oh.
I thought you were going to go to the sex museum yeah. in Josenkai.
Oh, no.
No.
And I do like the freeze frames when the women are looking directly into the camera, because it mm-hmm. really gives you that moment, that extra moment to connect with them. And that the whole scene of like the action cooking and the meditative aspects of just being able to stay with that moment, and once you see somebody that's a master doing what they do best, you can really it affects you on a deeper level.
Yes, it's sort of interesting also with the people looking into camera. He kind of raises the topic of voyeurism throughout the film, and I think when you see all these posters and statues, he talks about the mm-hmm. voyeurs being voyeurized, and he talks a lot about vertigo, which is famously associated with voyeurism. And to what extent do you think the film is about voyeurizing, and what do you think it might say about it?
So the other thing I want to point out about his voyeurs and voyeurism is when he talks about the Takinoko dancers, mm-hmm. and he says, because he's already talked about how Japanese television and Japanese murals have this aspect of voyeurism, and even watching the voyeurs and the interplay between that. But then when he talks about the Takinoko dancers, and he says they pretend that they don't, that nobody notices them, but yet they're actively cultivating, you know, people watching them. That was also, that's one of my favorite scenes. Those Takinoko dancers, I could watch an entire movie just of that.
And he's describing the, like the invisible wall between them and the people gathering around, you know, you can really see that. I mean, there's also like, I think maybe could call into question, because so much of the film is about looking, how it might evoke ethnographic films. You know, I sort of wonder about how Chris Marker wants us to see other people in other cultures, because like your first impression could be that it's maybe purely in terms of exoticism, the exotic. I don't know, like Jason, did you have that reaction to it, that this is like an ethnographic film, or do you think he's maybe saying something contrary to that?
A much younger Jason would have definitely seen that.
Right.
But having seen so many other films, and I had written down in my notes here about Jean Renoir's The River, which was financed purely to get a color image of India mm-hmm. into the Western world so that we could all experience the exotic imagery. Now it just seemed like this was Chris Marker telling a story about his travels, concocting a tale with just a footage that he took around the world. I mean, it to me, it's a little more boastful. Like, this is everything that I've experienced, and it's enough that I can create this tale for you. There are some moments where it's in there. Especially in those few scenes with the freeze frames, and when he's kind of toying with his subject,
John, what did you think of the maybe that aspect of the film?
Yeah, so here I have to give away more of my bias. I think if it were Godard that had done this, I would have just immediately, that's what I would have gravitated towards, saying, oh, this is just ridiculous. But since it's Chris Marker, I think I give him a pass. I guess, yeah. So I guess the way that I've explained it in my head is, I don't know where I saw this, but essentially he, in the rare times where he would give interviews over the computer, he said essentially what he would prefer, if he were a rich man, all he would do is go around the world, he would travel the world, and he would make home movies. But he's not a rich, well, I don't know. I think that's disputed as well, just how wealthy he was. But he says, I'm not a rich man, so instead I have to get people to pay for me to make my home movies. But that's what I'm doing here. Part of this is just a record of my travels. And I think there are scenes that are incorporated to the movie that are just, that was Chris Marker going for a walk that day with his video camera, and he stumbled upon a thing, and he decided he was going to put it into the movie. And then he was going to spin off from there. So I don't know. If I was forced to look at this as an ethnographic movie, I don't think I would like the movie as much. So I think I'd, again, selective memory, because the things I like about this movie, I like so much. Mm-hmm. I think I block out some of the things that are less impressive.
Well, it's funny too. Like, Jason, you mentioned that perhaps there's a bit of a boastful tone to it. And it's like when he goes and documents that little Tokyo restaurant, I noticed there were stills of La Jetée hanging on the wall, and I sort of felt like, of course he'd want to go and document the film that shows his maybe most famous film, or just the fact that there's so many of his little pet motifs coming up throughout the film, like just all the cats, ceramic cats, real cats, pictures of cats just from all over the world. It's like no matter where you went, you had to say, oh, there's a cat, I gotta film it, I gotta get it on film. It feels a little bit like that. But it's like some of the images could feel so abstract, like when he's just filming the Japanese television commercials and it's up close, so you see the scan lines of the TV. And then I noticed, like, after a while that you can see him in the reflection of the television. And all of a sudden the image changes, like all this abstraction you sort of realize is just an image of somebody watching the TV, and you can see them in the film. So it made me think again a little bit about how we watch things and how that's maybe folded in on itself with this film.
And just to go into what Jonathan was saying about if you saw it as exoticism or ethnographic, your experience would be completely different. And I can tell you that my wife tapped out after like 20 minutes.
Right.
And she went and did anything else. She did not want to be near the television anymore, just because she couldn't see the art film that you would only see after watching hours and hours and hours of art films.
So what do you think are those art film qualities that tip you off that, like, this isn't just a ethnographic documentary, that, you know, there is something poetic going on, there's something a little bit more complex in these images and how they're associated?
So one thing that I would say here is that I watched this movie towards the end of my I went through the BFI top 50, Sight and Sound top 50, following actually this podcast as well, as soon as I discovered it, so perfect. And then I watched this movie. And so I actually feel like in some ways this movie served as a capstone course, or a summation of a lot of the watching that I had already done. Part of what makes this, not part of what makes this an art film, but one of the aspects of this that might signal that this is in the art film arena, is that he mentions several other art films.
Yes.
He mentions his own movie, which is in the top 50. He mentions Apocalypse Now. He mentions Vertigo. He mentions Tarkovsky's Stalker. And the movie is made in is basically man with a movie camera with somebody talking over it, in a lot of ways. And on top of that, Joan of Arc is referenced. And I know for a fact that he wrote an article about Joan of Arc. So, You know, so that's probably the first thing that tipped me off that this might be an art film was when he references several other art films.
Sure, like when he says that, oh, this digitizing of the footage, you know, we like to call it The Zone as an homage to Stalker. He sort of wants you to keep that in mind, that this is the arena of images you're supposed to be in while watching this film. I think, anyway, that's part of the intent. Or one sequence I like very much is where the title comes from, when he's describing this I think it's Iceland, the landscape, how alien it is, and he sort of comes up with this hypothetical science fiction film that, you know, it sounds almost like Le Jeté, that he describes, and then says, oh, like, you know, it'd be called Sans Soleil, but I'd never make it, I'd never finish it. And you sort of realize, like, okay, like, that's not what he's doing here, isn't documentary, it's something else. And it's almost like a more stripped down version of Le Jeté for that sequence, where, you know, even though he's using motion images, there's no actors, there's no anything. It's just this environment and a description of what the film would be, which is sort of enough to put it in your head, which I found effective. You know, it's almost like on the Silver Globe with Andrzej Żuławski describing what these amazing science fiction scenes would be while you're seeing footage of Polish escalators, you know. you know, and I don't know if you have any other thoughts. Like, Jason, I don't know if there's anything that stands out as separating this from documentary, maybe making it more like an art film or more poetic, if there's any aspects I think are worth highlighting.
Well, it just so happens that before you guys reached out, I had been reading a book which just isolates me, perhaps as a nerd. The book is called Essayism by Brian Dillon. Mm-hmm. And it just so happens that as I was reading that, I come back to revisit this. I could see documentary style. I can see narrative fiction style. But it's the two quotes that stuck out in the book that reminded me of the film is, style is the price, not the rule. So he just earned it, the stylish piece of art, just by creating what he wanted to create. And the second one, which after thinking about it a couple of times, he's in the book, he's talking about using a list inside of a narrative to break things up. And I wanted to read this quote here. Excuse me. It is a structure that does not admit of qualification or reserve, narrative switchback or second thoughts, dependent clauses or sinuous trains of thought. It starts and it stops, but it is not exactly a freeze of unrelated cells, something that someone must link the discrete elements themselves, make a tick-tock out of the tick-tick. And he's just presenting us with everything.
Yes.
And letting us make that decision.
That's really interesting. I mean, that makes me think of the very first image shown, children on a road in Iceland, and talking about how he tried to pair it with all these other images. And it even shows you fighter jets, suggesting that, like, oh, this could have been next to it. But at the end, ultimately says, well, you know, I'll just have to put it with Black Leader because I can't fit it with everything, with anything. Sure. You know, so if people don't get the first image, at least they'll have the blackness. So it sort of made me think that, you know, even if you can't pair any of these images together at all, at least, you know, even the gaps might hold meaning. I think that's part of the way to watch the film. It sort of lays it out with that first juxtaposition, which is between this image of the three Icelandic kids and then nothing at all.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you're onto a good lead there, because the other thing that jumps out at the beginning is when he says, oh, and did you know that there are emus in the Ile de France? and that tells me, and I didn't get it the first few times I watched it. I guess it's one of those things you only pick up after you watch it five times. But what I realize is you pair that with what he says at the beginning. Not only is he talking about the act of creation, but he's also going through his free, like, it's almost like the actual free association that a person would have. So in some ways, the movie is supposed to be a consciousness. It's supposed to be the way that people remember things, sometimes incompletely, sometimes randomly. And so that's also another thing that suggests, you know, this might not be a straightforward documentary.
And then he uses the emu again to button the whole thing up at the end. Like, oh, and did you know that these emus were here?
Yeah, that's a good point. The sound design, I also thought, had a lot to do with that, because the associations are so abstract sometimes between what's being shown and what you're hearing. Like, even with the narration over top, like, you know, I was thinking at one point there's like a throat singing, you know, maybe Tibetan style throat singing with footage of rockets taking off while the narration's talking about some anecdote from Japan. It's sort of these very contrasting elements, and yet they sort of blend together in a really interesting way that doesn't feel jarring, strangely enough.
What's interesting about this movie, in terms of the historical aspect of it, so the movie came out, I think, what, 1983? If I had watched this movie 3 years ago, I think I would have thought to myself, is this still relevant? But now, I watch this movie. I mean, when I go to the gym, my gym annoyingly has like six TVs in front of the Stairmaster. And on the six TVs, there's MSNBC, CNN, and Fox News. Watching those three simultaneously right now, I might as well be... I wish they would just do the zone thing and and make all the images just spectral. just do it that way. Digitize them on the spectral synthesizer that way, because I'm about to lose my mind. So I've stopped using the Stairmaster, I think is what I'm trying to say. But yeah, no, it's scary how relevant this movie is, and the fact that the movie points out history will repeat itself. The only thing that changes is the particulars. The underlying image is, you know, history is still there, and we just forget about it until it comes back.
Right. I like what he says about how could people remember anything before video or film? Like, the way he phrases it, it's almost like, how is that even possible that you could remember anything? And his sort of prediction about the future, that everything be filmed or videotaped and kept on magnetic tape. But I mean, there's no magnetic tape, but we definitely live at a time when more or less everything is recorded. You know, and we're like watching Sans Soleil, you go out or you put on TV and you're sort of bombarded by so many images. You know, it's like the phrase that came to mind, it's like a hyperinflation of images, where, you know, they have more meanings than ever before, but maybe less meaning. You know, I don't know if that's maybe the postmodern thing, where just by having all these images and perspectives, it kind of takes away from the idea that any one of these images might have a sort of singular, intact meaning unto itself. And I think that's something that sort of becomes apparent in the nature of film editing. Like, again, going back to Histoire de Cinema, I think there's a line in there about how like, oh, you know, if an image had some intrinsic meaning, then putting it up against another image shouldn't alter its meaning. But it does. You know this from watching a film, that's part of film grammar. So it does kind of, you know, in a way that I think Sans Soleil sort of makes you reconsider the nature of film grammar and images, you know, in a way that's perhaps comparable to Histoire de Cinema, but it's probably more watchable here.
Well, I think that if I had never watched the Cotsy trilogy, mm-hmm. I would have been a lot more interested in the sound design in this film, just because what you're talking about, how the image and the sound, they're enhanced while separate, because they don't sync up necessarily. Yes. As they are. I did like what you were saying, and while I would never actually do this as a human being or even make my enemies do it, I think it might be interesting to like play video from MSNBC and audio from Fox News over the same over the same topic.
Jason, I'm never going to be able to get that like concept out of my head now.
Although that is slightly better. I thought you were going to say watch Histoire de Cinema.
No, there could be the cure to cancer in that, and I'm not going to watch it again.
Uh, But I mean, that's kind of the effect that you have. Like when you go on the internet, for instance, and you have tabs open and there's ads and windows, and you go on Twitter and you'll see like some heated political statement next to a picture of a puppy dog, next to you know, image from Tarkovsky's Stalker. Like that's kind of the experience of watching this film. I think it's like scrolling through Twitter, maybe.
I can't imagine how Chris Marker would feel with just this idea that we have like 40 24-hour news channels,
right?
And what are you saying about everything being preserved and just twisted and everything? And plus then you add in the internet where people without faces can come up and tell you how terrible you are or mm-hmm. how great you are. I imagine he would have gone a bit mad, or slightly more mad.
Or maybe he would have loved it.
Oh, no question. No question. Yeah. No, I think he has a lot to say that's really accurate about how we live in 2017. And I know that Chris Marker, I think he died in, what, 2008? He was very active. Oh, no, 2012. You're right. Sorry.
I just looked it up to make sure he was not alive.
He was very active on the internet. His web presence was one of the parts of his philosophy was always adopt the newest technology. And if you see pictures of a studio, there's, you know, there's all types of synthesizers and laptops around, even until his 80s. I think he did a CD-ROM.
Yeah, he did. Like almost like a video game. Yeah.
So while he clearly understands the dangers and how this sort of inundation with imagery can make us numb to what's going on and can almost be a form of amnesia, even though we remember everything, it's like an amnesia of the future. I also think he was simultaneously saying, you know what, with technology, it is my job as an artist and as a person who's interested in culture or maybe it wasn't even, he didn't consider it his job. Maybe he just considered it his joy that was just a part of what he did. And he, you know, sort of worked that into his philosophy. So I think he would have been very conflicted about it. I think he would have loved to have seen that Black Mirror episode where the guy has the memory chip in his brain and can remember everything that happens and the pain and misery that causes him. I think he would have, I think Chris Marker would be both appalled at what's going on, but he would have very much said, yeah, I've seen this before.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. No, that's well said. This might be apparent at this point, but would you say it's worthy of its place at the 69th spot on the Sight and Sound list?
Yeah, so I have been accused of being hyperbolic in the past, but I cannot help from being hyperbolic here. I think what I'd like to do is I'd like to take Histoire du Cinéma out of the 250 altogether.
Okay.
And I would like to put Sans Soleil into the top 50. Perhaps mm-hmm. I like this more than Le Jeté. So I know that that's probably a controversial opinion, but there you go. I really like this movie and would probably put it pretty high up. The other thing I would like to say, and this is where the hyperbole comes in, is that if Bob Dylan just won the Nobel Prize for Literature, so if a songwriter could win the Nobel Prize for Literature, you might imagine that a more literary filmmaker could also win the Nobel Prize for Literature. I think he's probably in the top two. I think him and Bergman, probably Godard, even though he's not my cup of tea, probably would be like the third member of people that would be eligible, you know, that would be in the running now if they were still alive. But I think Sans Soleil puts this is a major work of art. I don't know many other pieces of visual art that I enjoy more than this. So yeah, I couldn't say enough positive things about this.
Oh, that's great. Jason, do you think it's worthy of the 69th spot on the list?
One thing that that I talked about the last time I was on the show, the podcast, is that once you get onto, does it deserve to be on this list of the top 250? Absolutely. Especially after this conversation, I feel that even a little more strongly. But once you get into, we're talking like the top 0.5%, 0.05 maybe percent of all films made. I kind of feel like order at this point in time is kind of just relative, because if I look at it at the 69th spot and then just look five movies past it, is, in my opinion, is like The Third Man or Grand Illusion better? Yes. But the idea that Chris Marker was able to really capture life in the 1980s that can easily be reflected on 2017. Mm-hmm. If you're willing to give it the time and willing to invest your time and energy into it, I don't have any problem with it being there. I again would also, with Jonathan, happily take Histories out this an extra
on
boost.
That episode we all kind of agreed that it probably shouldn't be on the list, so mm-hmm. that slot's free, I guess we can what was that, 48? Yeah, let's say this should be at 48.
Okay. Great.
So there you have it, listeners. Nobel Prize for Chris Marker and higher place on the Sight and Sound list for Sans Soleil. So I think we're just going to wind out with our final notes of positivity. John, what's one piece of pop culture or shoe, movie, comic book that you've been enjoying lately?
I am definitely going to stick with movies. But first, I just want to say thank you so much for having me on. This is one of my favorite podcasts. And I went down the BFI Sight and Sound Top 50, and I finished actually in Lincoln Center at New York, and I listened to your podcast much of the way through. So this is a special treat for me to be on. And Jason, it's also great
to... Thank you so much for coming on. And thank you.
And Jason, it's great to be on with you. You and I have chatted, and you've made fun of me a bunch of times virtually. So it's great to actually be like an even closer virtual connection. Sure. My piece of positivity, besides just being so grateful to be on the podcast, is the movie Good Time by the Safdie brothers. The Safdie brothers graduated from BU. I'm a Bostonian, and so I went and saw the movie, and I'm a big fan of the movie After Hours. By Martin Scorsese, and I know that this movie directly inspired them, and they actually selected this when the Safdie brothers came to Boston, and there was like they were showing the movie and doing a conversation afterwards, and they were showing another movie beforehand, and so it has that. But imagine After Hours, just I hate to say it, but cranked up to 11, and that's what you get, and it's wicked fun. It's immediately suspenseful. The woman who I went with was sitting next to me, and she was biting her t-shirt the entire time, just out of sheer like trying to relieve the tension of how intense the movie was, and in a good way. And I just thought it was a great movie, so go out and see it. You know, not enough people are going to the movie theaters and seeing movies. I know I should be more like Chris Marker and welcome new technologies, but man, I really want to be able to go and see movies in movie theaters. So go buy the tickets, go see the movie. It's wonderful. And overall, A24 has a wonderful lineup coming out this year, The Florida Project by our friend Sean Baker.
Sean Baker's new film with Willem Dafoe, that looks really good.
Yeah. So a lot of good movies coming out. Good Time was great. But really, just I'm like imploring everybody. I mean, the people on this podcast already know, but go see the movie twice. That's my note of positivity.
I like it. Jason, what's something you've been digging lately?
Okay, first, just a couple other notes. I also found this podcast because I watched my way through the top 50. I found it maybe a couple weeks after I finished, but I struck up a conversation with Lady P, and it was just a great time. And I've, much like Jonathan, am grateful to be able to help other viewers experience these films the same way that we can, and that get the same levels of joy and entertainment out of them. To what Jonathan said, I might not be a nice guy all the time, and I may have made fun of him, This it. Listen,
I probably deserved it.
I'm glad almost you got you kicked out. Decide to come on to talk about this movie.
And that moment when you said that you're from Boston and everything, like Kill Bill flashback to see everything happening. And it was perfect. It was a great moment for me, and I appreciate that, Jonathan. Now, for notes of positivity, while I could easily say I watched Suspiria in 4K, and it was amazing, and to what Jonathan said, if you can get to a theater, go and give them your money, give them your time, and tell them what kind of stuff you want to see. But I kind of have to take it to the small screen, because my wife and I just finished The Leftovers, and I'm going to try my best to not spoil anything, but I can say that out of almost all of the television programs I've seen, not once has the show stuck the landing so good and so perfectly as Leftovers. It's a bonkers show throughout its three seasons, but it just ended so, so perfectly that it reminded me what good writing and directing and production can do. So that would definitely be my note of positivity. But Suspiria, if you can check it out, do so. And they have a Blu-ray coming out, so looks amazing.
I think mine's already pre-ordered. I
I threw my money as fast as possible.
Yes.
So
we went from big screen to small screen. I'm going to go one screen smaller. And my pick, it's... I don't know if you guys know the Lasagna Cat YouTube channel.
No.
But they have a sort of weird Garfield parody videos. And one of them, I think the title, it's 07/27/1978. And it's a Garfield strip, comic strip, where Garfield just steals John's pipe. But it's a man analyzing that strip for an hour straight. And it's over the soundtrack to Kundun, and the man, he's John Blythe Barrymore, and he's just staring at a camera and talking nonstop, analyzing every aspect of this pipe comic strip. And it's sort of you know, the joke is, how can somebody talk about this little comic, three panel comic, for an hour? But I've watched the whole thing more than once now, and it sort of makes you feel like, you know, you can find meaning in everything or anything, and then anything can be absurd. Maybe life is absurd. Maybe you have to find meaning. Like, I found it actually surprisingly philosophically engaging, kind of moving in its own way, but also really funny and just ridiculous. So maybe people can watch that on YouTube. It's maybe in line with Chris Marker in some way by being cat oriented and very unusual. So if folks want to follow you on the internet, where might be the best place for them to look, John?
So I am I have a podcast, Film Baby Film. I haven't done anything with the podcast in the last month because, fortunately and unfortunately, well, really it's fortunately, I got to tape an episode or episodes of a game show, so I've been very busy.
Cool.
I'm not allowed to say anything specific about it, but it is Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, and I was on it, and it was
that's
awesome.
How you became a millionaire.
Or a thousandaire, or somewhere in between, whatever. Let's leave it very ambiguous. But yeah, so, well, I guess one way you could find me is to watch Who Wants to Be a Millionaire this upcoming season. Another way is I am going to be restarting Film Baby Film podcast, and so you can find me at filmbabyfilm.com. You can find me on Instagram or Twitter at Film Baby Film. That is definitely the best way to get in touch with me. A friend of this podcast, Dave Eves, he will be coming on this weekend. We'll be reviewing an Ingmar Bergman film. So,
oh, that's going to be great.
That's exciting.
Yep.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to getting back into that. So this has been particularly great, and thanks for letting me be a part of the magic, and I can't wait until, you know, free Lady P, hashtag free Lady P.
Never. No, she'll be back soon. Jason, where can folks find you on the internet?
On Twitter, at Admiral Beamish. And I write, I own, I suppose, the website filmruminations.com, which I know is possibly one of the worst names for a URL just because it's not an easy word. I did spell it correctly, though. But so I write there a couple times a week, reviewing new Blu-ray and home releases. And on Instagram and in Criterion Geyer, we're there often. So.
Oh, great. So thank you both for coming on. If folks want to ignore the bliss of forgetting, don't forget to rate and review the show. And until next time, take care.